This is Joe Basso from Music Radar, and I'm speaking with Chris Cornell, former singer with Soundgarden, Audioslave, and solo artist. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. I woke up with a good radio voice today.
Well, then
this
then
is like post three shows in a row of 3 hour sets, and my voice goes down. If I wasn't on tour, it wouldn't normally be this low.
You were telling me before tape started rolling that you just saw the Anvil documentary.
Yes, and the tape part was what got me thinking about it. It's a fantastic documentary, by the way, of a band where the filmmakers really have a lot of respect for the subjects. You know, they're not making fun of them. Mm-hmm. They're really trying to portray a true story that. This is one that has uniqueness, but also there's a universal nature to it as well, because there are so many, many, many bands and artists and musicians and guitarists that work so hard, and against all odds, you know, they continue to do what they do because they love it, but, you know, they never reach that brass ring kind of thing. And time affects that so much, and I in the film, and this is, you know, a recent documentary, it's in fact just released.
Yes.
The singer is still making demos on cassette tapes and mailing those cassette tapes to people that he wants to hear. Like, he mails a cassette tape to a producer to listen to their new songs. And it's just funny how in the lives and just the habits of, like, guys that had their heyday in a band in the 80s, they're still using cassettes. I don't even know where to go to buy a cassette tape now.
You can buy them at pharmacies, actually.
Really?
Yes.
And I don't have anything. I do think if I really looked hard, I could find something to play it on.
Let's start talking about your new record, which is called Scream.
Uh-huh.
Which is one thing that you're not doing a lot on the record, by the way. You're not screaming a lot.
Not really. I probably scream more on the songs when I'm doing them live than I do on the album. I do a hell of a lot of singing on it, though.
You do a lot of singing on it.
More than I've ever done on anything. Whoops.
On the cover, you're smashing a guitar.
Mm. No, I'm not.
Or you're about to smash a guitar.
I'm flying through the air with a guitar.
You're flying through the air.
In the middle of the packaging, I'm smashing.
You're pre-smash.
Yeah.
But this looks different than kind of a Pete Townsend smash. This seems, unless I'm reading something into it, this seems to have a different implication. What is there a message behind you about to smash the guitar?
Not really. Nothing of any weight, really. The initial idea of the image was, A, it's a cool image, it's a powerful image. B, it's sort of like an unapologetic portrayal to the idea that I'm making an album that's not a guitar-based album in
right.
any way. But it's not like a heavy-handed like statement against guitars. There's guitars on every single song on the album. Obviously, when I tour, like, it's pretty much a 3-hour event of people playing guitars. So it was. But the initial idea was that sort of, you know, unapologetic statement that this is going to be a different record. This is going to be a different album. But then it did something else that I didn't really expect. Which is that it looked a lot, based on what I'm wearing, and my hair was a little longer, just like a shot that could have came out of the 1990 Soundgarden tour. And in that way, I really liked it, because it was sort of like, in a way, image-wise, reclaiming that past, which I kind of ran away from really quickly. There was a period in there. As soon as that was kind of like long-haired grunge rock god image for people to even talk about or throw around, like the one that was on the cover of Spin magazine or something, I ran from that as fast as I could. You know, I shaved my head, I stopped wearing boots and shorts and whatever else I, you know, could do to not look like that.
I think a lot of the question on people's mind, because it is a very different type of album, is why Timbaland? Why did you want to work with him?
Well, it was really kind of a decision that happened based on conversation. You know, it was a quick call, and it was a thought of, you know, here's somebody. Once we got into a conversation about making an album, that was really enthusiastic about making the whole album. The idea of working with Timbaland, I knew that it wouldn't be like anything else I'd ever done at all. Music, it wouldn't sound like anything else. The process of making it wouldn't be like anything else I'd ever done, and that totally appealed to me.
And I always thought about like adding loops and beats and things like that sort of into songs and into albums, but
you know, it seemed to me to make more sense to just go headlong into it and really kind of dive into a dramatically different direction for a minute and just kind of rinse everything that I know about making records away from the experience of writing and recording this new record. And that happened, pretty much.
What did you learn from Timbaland?
Well, it's a process, you know, it's different. There are a lot of things that, the first thing that I learned is that there's sort of this universal language called music where two guys are trusting each other on an endeavor that ended up being like 6 months long. And we come from completely different cultures, we come from different places geographically, different musical genres, different everything. And our approaches to writing and recording music are completely different. But yet we got together and wrote 20 songs in 6 weeks. That's kind of, to me, the most important thing that I got out of it, that sort of cliche music is the universal language ideal is pretty intact for me.
Mm-hmm.
If you do the math, you would, even I would think, like, how are these two people going to actually manage to come together given their separate influences? What influences are they going to have to mine to actually be able to write songs and make an album that makes any sense at all? Both of us having such a depth and of knowledge of music and bands and record collections and influences, it was totally possible, but it was also completely unpredictable.
Right.
If you listen to, I think if you go and you listen to the first song, Part of Me, it's kind of, in my mind, what someone might expect from the combination of me and Timbaland. But as the record unfolds, it goes into places that don't sound like anybody else's record. Doesn't sound like anything I've ever done or he's ever done. And that's what's exciting to me about it.
Going into it, did you have any idea that it was going to be perceived as such a left turn?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what's obvious. It's not like I haven't done that before, but this is more perceptually that, for sure. To me, there my audience, there's no such thing really. It's sort of it's a fractured group of people who are fans from different periods of my career, and then some percentage of those people are fans of everything. Otherwise, it's kind of divided up into hard rock fans or fans of solo work or fans of Soundgarden or fans of Audioslave some fans that only really like things I've done outside of those bands that like the less aggressive music that I've done. But this clearly would be a huge departure from anything any of those fans are used to.
Right.
That part was obvious just in the thought in my own mind. Like, making a record with Timbaland will definitely make it, you know, everybody's head spin a little bit.
I've read comments where you did say that you knew going into it that a lot of your audience, or at least a portion of your audience, would probably not like it.
Yeah.
Did that bother you? Because I would think as an artist, of course you do want people to like your work.
Well, it's not that I don't want people to like it. It's that, like, if I sit down with, like, if you filled this room that we're speaking in with fans of mine, and then we all sort of took out iPods or whatever, you know, a sheet of paper and wrote down our favorite songs, my taste in music is probably going to be different from everybody else's and theirs from each other, and maybe
right.
theirs from mine, and that's sort of what it all boils down to. It's like the idea of creating an audience with music to then service that audience has never really made a lot of sense to me. And I think that the artists that I've followed that have been the most important to me in my career have been people that have sort of done what they've felt they wanted to do or needed to do or were inspired to do musically. So the idea of writing a song and the with the ultimate goal being that a certain group of people like it has to not exist for me.
Okay.
I could not ever be thinking about that when I write a song, and otherwise I would have a difficult time.
Do you foresee a time when you're going to go back to doing hard rock?
In a sense, I mean, I do that every night on tour, and I tour a lot, so it's still very much a part of my life. And B, I don't, you know, there's never going to be a time when I don't want to go write and perform and record a hard rock song that's new. I almost look at my career of songwriting as trying to like always find that moment, that perfect moment and that perfect song that, that somebody else has written but I've never been able to get my hands on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There are songs on screen that are like that.
Right.
Ground Zero was like that. That's a song, you know, that reminds me of artists that I love from the soul period of when I was a child. The song Pretty Noose on the last, on the Down on the Upside Soundgarden album, that's a great example of I just wanted to write that song. You know, it just had all these components of a straightforward rock song, but that was interesting and melodic that we just didn't have, and I was pissed off that I couldn't have a song like that to go out and play for people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Obviously, the first record is a great example. I came off of Euphoria Morning, which was really sort of somber and melancholy, yeah, and melodic, although very complicated in terms of guitar work. Musically, the most complicated album I've ever made. I got a lot of questions like that then, you know. So now you're doing Euphoria Morning, this is your first thing since Soundgarden broke up, so obviously we're going to assume this is what you'd rather be doing. And my answers then were the same. I was like, no, this is just, you know, I was in an aggressive band for a long time, and this was an opportunity to do some other stuff. Next thing I did was the first Audioslave record, which is extremely aggressive, the most aggressive of the three that we did. So I'm always going to want to do that. I mean, you know, part of that need and part of it gets sort of fulfilled by the fact that I do tour a lot and I do get to play aggressive songs nightly. But the songwriter in me is always going to want to do a lot of different things.
A non-aggressive song on the album, but one that I think is quite nice, is called Two Drink Minimum.
Uh-huh.
Is that you playing guitar on there?
No. Actually, the only thing on there from the original session is the vocals.
Okay.
Because what happened was, Jerome Harmon, who plays keyboards all over the album, it was sort of the 5 o'clock in the morning, kind of winding down on a recording session. He just started playing the melody of what the guitar melody is when you hear it, but he was playing it on keyboard, and it was kind of like a Stevie Wonder sort of chromatic harmonica sound. And I just quickly came up with the vocal melody and wrote the lyrics and sang it in, you know, one take over what he played.
It's really nice.
And then when I actually wasn't there, they loved it. Tim loved it so much. Everybody loved it. They actually had a live band just come in and play to my singing. And that's what that ended up being. And somehow or another, and I don't know how, you can maybe research this and help me out because no one's been able to tell me, but a lot of people think that John Mayer played on it. Did you hear that?
I did not hear that.
Yeah,
no.
People ask me about the collaboration, which there wasn't one. I even actually tried to get him to play on it at the last minute, thinking, now since there's a big rumor that he's played on it, well, why not just get him to play on it? And then when they ask me, I can say, well, it was fantastic.
Well, there's a live duet that can happen one day.
Well, yes, it made me call him, and now we're friends, so it turned out really good.
So now we can put out to the world, John Mayer, if you're listening, show up at a gig and play this song with him.